Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Pelvic Messenger. Originally created by Elizabeth Oss, The Pelvic Messenger seeks to provide evidence-based education and hope to individuals who manage chronic pelvic and sexual pain conditions and the healthcare providers who care for them. The Pelvic Messenger is managed and supported by Amy Stein, owner of Beyond Basics Physical Therapy in New York City, and Alexandra Millspaugh, owner of Four Directions Counseling in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. We also receive financial support from the International Pelvic Pain Society, who hosts an annual multidisciplinary conference on the diagnosis and treatment of chronic pelvic and sexual pain disorders every October. For more information on the IPPS and their annual meeting, please visit www.pelvicpain.org. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for joining us on the Pelvic Messenger Talk Radio Show. My name is Alexandra Lang, and I'm a physical therapist who works at Beyond Basics Physical Therapy in New York City, and I'll be your host. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with physiotherapist Carolyn Van Dyken. Carolyn graduated from McMaster University in 1986 with a degree in physiotherapy and has practiced in a wide variety of clinical settings, focusing primarily on orthopedics. She has been a McKenzie's credentialed physiotherapist since 1999 and has been a member of the Canadian College of Medical Acupuncture since 2002. Her clinical focus changed to pelvic health and incontinence in 2001. Carolyn was the co-founder of Pelvic Health Solutions, a Canadian-based postgraduate teaching company. Carolyn presents extensively internationally on pelvic health and central sensitization. She has published numerous framework articles on integrating central pain mechanisms into clinical practice, a pain education book, and several chapters and textbooks on pelvic pain and central sensitization. She is actively involved in research with Dr. Dufour at McMaster University and has published several studies on the connection between low back pain and pelvic floor dysfunction. Carolyn won the Distinguished Education Award from the Ontario Physiotherapy Association in 2015. While Carolyn and I are talking today, we'd love to hear from our listeners. So if you're listening and you have a question, please feel free to call in. The number is 323-693-3847. So thank you for coming, Carolyn, and welcome to the Pelvic Messenger.
Thank you, Alexandra, for inviting me and for having me.
We're very happy to have you. I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a little bit about your presentation at this year's International Pelvic Pain Society conference in October.
Sure, that sounds great. So I presented on low back pain and pelvic floor dysfunction and the connection between the two. I actually titled my talk Sibling Rivalry, and there was a reason for that. And one of the main reasons is because as physiotherapists, and I'm going to say physiotherapists because I'm in Canada, but of course that's physical therapists in the U.S., as physiotherapists, we really do live in silos, right? We either kind of identify as an orthopedic therapist, as a pelvic health therapist, or we identify as a pain science therapist, someone who uses a lot of centrally driven assessment and treatment techniques for the nervous system. And so we need to kind of get out of our silos and recognize that really when we're treating the person in pain, especially with lumbopelvic pain, we need to actually develop expertise in all of those areas. So that was the title of the presentation, and I based the presentation then on three studies that we have completed over the last 2 years. And the first study really was looking at connecting pelvic health to lumbopelvic pain. And so in that study, we actually recruited 182 women. We started with recruiting men as well, but we only had two or three men recruited by the end of the study, and so we had to exclude them. But we looked at 182 women, and then that translated down to about 108 women who met the inclusion criteria, and we'll probably talk about that a little bit later. What this study showed, and we've actually had a lot of sort of historical empirical evidence that lumbopelvic pain and pelvic floor dysfunction are connected, strongly connected. There's been many research studies that have said, you know, about 75% of women with lumbopelvic pain have a pelvic floor problem. The problem was that no one up to that point had actually then done an internal exam with these women to determine whether or not they had an overactive pelvic floor or a weak pelvic floor or they lacked coordination. So in that study, we actually recruited women from an orthopedic practice. They had come into the orthopedic practice for low back pain, and once they met the inclusion criteria, then we asked them if they would participate in the study. And then the study was done by two blinded therapists, one who then assessed them orthopedically and the other assessed them internally. And they also filled out a lot of screening questionnaires, which was also blinded from both therapists at the same time. And what that study showed was that actually for in this study of 108 women, 96% of women who came in with lumbopelvic pain self-reported pelvic floor dysfunction, which 100% correlated with then objective testing of pelvic floor dysfunction. Mm. What was interesting about the study was that the assumption has always been made in orthopedic practice that if there is a pelvic floor problem, it's that women are weak, that they have incontinence, they need to do more core strengthening. And what our study showed was that 71%, by far the majority of women, had tenderness on palpation, which is interpreted as an overactive pelvic floor. So that was kind of where we started with the first study. And then the second study we did, we wanted to take a look then at trying to identify for orthopedic therapists using a screening tool. The research question was, can we use a screening tool without doing an internal exam to help orthopedic therapists then figure out if the person in front of them with pelvic floor dysfunction has an overactive pelvic floor, a weak pelvic floor, or a lack of coordination in their pelvic floor. And that research study actually was not able to demonstrate that we could do that. The only two pieces that were correlated in the screening tool was if a woman reports urinary urgency, there was, I want to say the odds ratio, let me just find that for a sec here, there was a 2.93 odds ratio that they would have an overactive pelvic floor if they had urinary urgency. And if they scored greater than 40 on the central sensitization inventory, there was a 3.13 odds ratio that they would have tenderness on palpation. So screening those two things can start to give some clues to orthopedic therapists, but beyond that, really doing an internal exam is what was required. And then the last study, and then I'll stop and let you ask some questions. But the last study then we looked at was what we saw in that second study was the strong correlation between central sensitization and tenderness on palpation. So what we did then was we actually looked at the construct validity of tenderness on palpation with all of the different parameters that we measured. So central sensitization, urgency, dysmenorrhea, dyspareunia, constipation, and incontinence. Now, for all of you who are like me and are not up on all our research terminology, construct validity, because I'm certainly not, I'm a clinician, that's why I work with some really smart researchers. So construct validity is the degree to which two measures that should be theoretically connected are in fact related. And what that third study, and that's just in final review and is ready to be published now, is that tenderness on palpation only had construct validity or was actually connected with central sensitization. So if you measure central sensitization using the CSI inventory, you can predict based on that screening questionnaire most tightly and most strongly that they have tenderness on palpation. But if you just go by the diagnosis, so dysmenorrhea, which you and I might suspect that someone with dysmenorrhea has likely a high likelihood of having tenderness on palpation, or dyspareunia, for example. But in fact, what this research study showed was that the only thing that predicted tenderness on palpation was a CSI score of greater than 40. And that kind of loops us right back again to lumbopelvic pain, because what we now know, the research has been showing us for the last 5 to 10 years, is that idiopathic low back pain, persistent low back pain, is strongly correlated with central sensitization and not biomechanical dysfunction. So it kind of has brought us full circle again.
Right. Wow. I didn't know about that last one, which is really interesting. So all of that research kind of puts me into two directions with questions. I think it's one of the things that our readers are going to be, or our listeners are going to be really interested in, is kind of this, the silos that you were talking about and kind of how we bridge that gap a little bit. But I think I'll start with the research questions, and then we can really get into all of that kind of towards the end. So specifically about the research, you know, we have to pick patients and clients who are available to us, but also who are really indicative of what we're trying to find. So how did you go about finding the subjects in your studies and choosing the inclusion and the exclusion criteria for each study?
Right. Okay. So the first study, which was looking at the correlation between lumbopelvic pain and pelvic floor dysfunction, the criteria was that, again, we were looking for men and women. We didn't get a lot of men, so we ended up with women. And this is really unfortunate because, again, I think in men, the whole pelvic health field is definitely underreported and understudied, right? We know that.
Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting because Van Wingerden did a lovely presentation at the First World Congress on abdominal pelvic pain in 2013 in Amsterdam. It was a poster presentation. It was a big study, like 1,636 people, men and women included. And what he was able to show, they were able to show in that study, and it's never been published, unfortunately. I've spoken to him about why, and it just kind of got on the back burner and never actually published it. So it's been presented at a conference but not published. What they were able to show in their cohort of men was that 36% of men who have lumbopelvic pain have pelvic floor dysfunction, so about one-third. And so that's probably, you know, and the general research has shown sort of two-thirds of women. Our study was 96% of the women in our study. So it was a really, really high cohort. We were looking for women who had low back pain for at least 1 week or hip pain for at least 1 week. They had to be willing to undergo an internal exam. We looked at the pain catastrophizing questionnaire because what we were trying to do was to look perhaps at people who were a little bit more mechanical. We were actually trying to screen out some of the more sensitized patients. And despite screening those patients out, we still ended up with this strong correlation between central sensitization and tenderness on palpation, which I find very interesting, right? So if they had a score of greater than 30, I don't know if you use the pain catastrophizing questionnaire, but that would indicate that they have a severe risk of ongoing disability at a year if that catastrophization is not identified and dealt with. So we excluded them. We also excluded anybody who was using narcotics and anyone who had English as a second language and couldn't kind of read and fill out the questionnaires in English. So those were our inclusion and exclusion criteria for the first study. For the second study, they were actually quite similar. What was really interesting, I'm just going to go back to the exclusion criteria for just a moment. What was really interesting about the exclusion criteria, so we had five clinics that were producing data and were involved in the study. Two of the sites probably were the most, the biggest producers of data for the study. And both physiotherapists who did the pelvic health component in that group, in both groups, were highly experienced, like a 20 years of clinical experience in pelvic health. And one site actually had a 4% refusal rate to have an internal exam, and the other site actually had a 43% refusal rate to have an internal exam.
Right.
And so when you looked at, we recruited 182 women, and then actually 108 women went into the study. The biggest reason for exclusion was, first of all, a pain catastrophizing scale of greater than 30. So there's a large subsection of women with chronic lumbopelvic pain who are severely catastrophizing. So we have to think about that, right? That is highly correlated, to central sensitization outside of what we found in these less catastrophizing women. So that's interesting. And the second thing that's interesting is this big differential between recruitment with these two sites. And what it came down to was the site that actually only had a 4% refusal, right from the front desk staff to the orthopedic therapist who was also screening potential women for inclusion in the study, they all were very comfortable talking about pelvic health and pelvic pain with their patients. right from the front desk staff. Whereas in the other clinic where there was a 43% refusal, this physiotherapist was kind of working in the back corner, the back office, was not interacting well with the orthopedic staff. The front desk staff was not comfortable screening for pelvic health. And so, you know, I think that large differential is primarily due to our discomfort and our inability to integrate pelvic health with even in our clinical practices. So that was kind of interesting.
When I was reading your articles, I thought that was really interesting as well. And I was wondering if through this experience or just in general, if you've thought of any ways to kind of minimize that occurrence. Is it just experience, or is there some type of education that we need to be putting into physical therapy schools to make this a more or less taboo topic, something that even orthopedic therapists can be a little bit more comfortable talking about with their patients?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it has to start in our academic sort of settings, right? With and you know, the reasoning I always hear is we don't have time. We're, you know, in Canada, everything is taught to the national exam. We have to prepare students, you know, the master's students to take the national exam. And because there's no questions on pelvic health, we're not talking about pelvic health in their master's programs. And so we're master's trained here, where you guys are DPT trained, so it's just a little bit different. But probably come up with the same sort of time crunch kind of issues. But, you know, when you have a patient population, so you think kind of worldwide, low back pain disability is the number one cause of disability worldwide, right? Mm-hmm. And as physiotherapists, that should be our bread and butter as orthopedic therapists.
Right.
And yet, if we see such a strong correlation between pelvic floor dysfunction and lumbopelvic pain, and we're not addressing or equipping our students to talk about sexual function, to talk about bladder function and bowel function beyond sort of caught equina screening, right, then, you know, we're doing a disservice not only to the clinicians but also to their patients. And I think that's what I kind of talk about these silos. We have to get out of our silos and realize – pelvic health is for everyone. It's not just for pelvic health therapists. And I recognize that not everyone is going to want to do or maybe is even appropriate to do internal work. I get that. But we all should upskill ourselves in understanding pelvic floor dysfunction as the current literature presents it. And there is, again, if we go back to the fact that when there's tension in the pelvic floor, when there's a problem in the pelvic floor, if you really think about this, Alexandra, pathologically, what really happens in the pelvic floor? Like, what's the pathology? There really isn't, right?
Right.
Would you agree? Yeah, because there really isn't. We have to kind of stop pathologizing. It's either tight or it's weak or it's sensitized. Well, what we know about pelvic floors is that, you know, go back to Vandervelde's work in 2001, right? The very first muscle to respond to stress, tension, and fear is your pelvic floor.
Right. Of any kind.
And so, yeah, right, exactly. So when we see problems with the pelvic floor, we need to start thinking, what's the threat? And we need to start thinking centrally. And we need to maybe get out of the tissues quite as much, which means that our orthopedic colleagues, if they're trained in pelvic health, even if they don't do internal exam, they can do a lot of good recognizing as well where their limits are and when to then refer on to somebody who does internal work. But they need that. They need that education from a non-internal perspective, right? And we just don't, it's not being done. That's a problem.
And I think there's so much research and there's now so much education about central sensitization as well. And we kind of all recognize the biopsychosocial model as a truth these days, especially through education. And yet we still, I think, especially in the orthopedic world, I might be doing them some people some disservice, but I think there's still, you know, we're looking for that pathology. We're looking for that movement disorder and trying to find kind of the one thing that's going to fix that. And that can sometimes pigeonhole patients and clinicians a little bit as well, which is an interesting problem.
I would agree. I think Butler and Lorimer mostly have, David Butler and Lorimer mostly have really kind of opened, and we should be really proud as physiotherapists that that pain science has come out of our profession, right? Mm-hmm. And to the degree that it has, but it has really stumped us because we are still very biomechanically trained. And so it's on one hand, we know central sensitization is a real problem. And on the other hand, what we're trained to do is to treat the tissues,
mm-hmm.
right? And so one of the things that I do is I teach a whole course on the phenotypes of central sensitization. So how do we identify someone with central sensitization? And then how do we look at what the constructs are for that individual person? You know, if they're depressed or stressed or anxious or fear avoidant or catastrophizing or they've got sensory motor smudging, because we have or we can develop a cohort of skills that's within our scope of practice that can address all of those different facets of central sensitization. And when we do that, what happens to the pelvic floor? It downregulates itself.
Mm-hmm.
We don't keep having to mash on, I'm going to put air quotes, you can't see me, but air quotes around trigger points, because we have a nice meta-analysis in 2019 that says, we don't even know what a trigger point is, right? We don't have a consistent definition for it. We now have enough evidence and research to say that treating trigger points in persistent pain doesn't work. And yet we're kind of hung up on that tissue-based component because not through any fault of our own, that's how we've been trained. And it's so hard to change that process right from academia forward, right?
Yeah. And so I found it a little interesting, but now it's kind of making sense to me, that you chose the pain catastrophizing scale as kind of your main outcome measure for most of these studies, and you never actually used any of the pelvic health outcome measures that do exist. Can you go walk me through a little bit the thought process for that?
Yeah. So this was, remember, this was actually not an RCT. We were not looking at, we didn't apply sort of a treatment regime and then look at outcomes, right? So what we were trying to do is actually use the screening questionnaires as predictive tools. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to select a patient population that we were trying to look for as a more straightforward, if you will, kind of orthopedic presentation. So we wanted to kind of get out, that's why we didn't allow narcotic usage, and we were really looking at high scores of catastrophization, because that would screen out the people who were very centrally sensitized. And despite that, we actually did still see a lot of central sensitization. Now, less so as well, in our second study, a lot of our sample, I would say maybe half of our sample size came from education classes. So when we were teaching postgraduate physiotherapy courses, if someone, we asked every class for a period of about 6 months, if you've experienced lumbopelvic pain in the past week, and if you're willing to participate in the study, you know, on you go type thing, right? So, did I lose you? No, we're good. So we did recruit a convenient sample at that point, and those folks were less likely to be catastrophizing. So even though there was strong construct validity between tenderness and palpation and central sensitization, what I would suspect if we actually used completely a typical patient population who was bothered enough by their pain that they were going to seek out treatment, that we'd see even a stronger correlation with that. I feel like I've lost you. Nope.
Right. I dropped out. I'm back. So sorry about that.
No, that's no problem. Do you want me to repeat what I said?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. So it's interesting because especially in the second study, we actually recruited a convenient sample, but half of the patients came from postgraduate courses that we were teaching. And if anyone had had lumbopelvic pain in the past week, or longer, they were invited to participate in the study. So you have to remember that these were not people who were then seeking care necessarily. These were physiotherapists who happened to have either acute or chronic low back pain or lumbopelvic pain. And so even despite that sort of convenient sample, what we found was a strong correlation between central sensitization and tenderness on palpation. my suspicion, and I think the study needs to be redone using completely, a patient sample that is seeking care, that we would see even a stronger correlation between central sensitization and tenderness on palpation. So what we were looking for in this study was, it was more of a predictive study, right? It was a prospective study looking at, could we predict? It wasn't an outcome study, or we would have probably used more of the incontinence measures or pelvic pain or sexual function sort of outcome measures as well.
Gotcha. And then going back to kind of the discrepancy between only having female subjects, mm-hmm. do you think that we found that 36% of men with low back pain also have pelvic floor dysfunction? My guess is that men tend to rate a little bit lower on a catastrophizing scale. Do you think there would still be a connection even with kind of those differences in what we might find on an outcome measure?
Right. We know that women just in general have more chronic pain. So if we look at mm-hmm. just a pure sort of volume perspective, we're going to see more women with higher catastrophizing scores and central sensitization scores than men. But I think the percentage of those patient populations will actually be pretty similar. If you think about your men who are struggling with chronic lumbopelvic pain, often there's high stress, high anxiety, high fear involved as well. And so I suspect when, my patient population in my clinical practice is about 20% men, and I mm-hmm. would say I don't think I have a less likelihood of seeing a male with central sensitization scores or catastrophization scores in a problematic range than women in my practice. I just see less men overall because there's gotcha. Just less, right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the reason that there were less men in your study is because they were less willing to undergo a manual assessment. Is that correct?
I suspect as well. And again, I was just one site in the recruitment part of the study, so I worked out of one site. I suspect as well that the orthopedic therapists who were drawing people into this study were less mm-hmm. likely to approach men than women. Do you see what I'm saying? So if they had a male lumbopelvic pain, they were less likely to approach them to participate in the study as women. I think there was definitely some confirmation bias on the orthopedic physiotherapist part. And I couldn't control that across 5 study sites, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can only control your site. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So they either weren't comfortable or kind of made their own assumption that it wasn't going to be as impactful for them.
Right, not as much of an issue. And we all have our confirmation biases, right? If we really have mm-hmm. to hold up a mirror, we all have our confirmation biases, and we're much more likely. It's just like with chronic pain. Men with chronic pain are much more likely to be given pain medication, and women are much more likely to be given antidepressants.
Right.
Right? There's this confirmation bias. And so I think that probably happened in the recruitment in the study, but I can't confirm that. But I would be highly suspicious.
Makes sense. So going forward, what would you like the clinical implications to be that are taken from the study? You have one that confirms that women with back pain will very likely have some type of pelvic floor dysfunction, whether it's a tight pelvic floor or a weak pelvic floor. And yet you couldn't find necessarily an objective measure to kind of screen for that for an orthopedic standpoint. Kind of going forward, how should we be utilizing this information?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So first of all, the screening questionnaire that we did validate, so it is valid in identification of pelvic floor dysfunction. It had actually 100% correlation with a blinded physiotherapist identifying pelvic floor dysfunction on these women. So it's valid to identify pelvic floor dysfunction. And I think for orthopedic therapists, probably the first step is to actually use a screening tool. If you're not comfortable, and that may be the place to start, use a screening tool for every person who comes into your office with lumbopelvic pain, hip pain, and screen for pelvic floor dysfunction. by asking, you know, the questions similar to the second study, which are, you know, do you urinate more than 8 times a day? Do you have difficulty initiating your urine stream or experience burning with urination? Do you experience very strong and/or uncontrollable urges to go to the bathroom? Do you experience any fecal or urine leakage on the way to the bathroom or with coughing, laughing, sneezing, or exercising? Again, so we're not looking to identify specifically. We're just looking for factors that connect to pelvic floor dysfunction or disorders. And then Do you have pain during or after a bowel movement? Do you struggle with having regular bowel movements? Do you experience painful intercourse? Do you experience pelvic pain and or pelvic pressure, i.e. vaginal, rectal, penile, testicular, bladder, tailbone, or pelvic girdle? And then for men only, do you experience any penile, testicular, or prostate pain? And for women only, do you experience pain or cramping with menstruation that requires intervention such as heat, medication, rest, etc.? So that's the screening tool that we used. And so just even to use that one or something similar to that, we were able to show that those questions identified women with pelvic floor dysfunction that was then 100% correlated by a blinded exam.
Wow.
So it starts, I think, in orthopedics to start screening for pelvic floor dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to start thinking about, this is beyond even just the studies that I'm talking about here. We really have to start thinking about, do we need to be strengthening everyone's core,
right?
Do we have evidence for that? And you and I both know the short answer is no, we don't actually. And this study is just one more kind of nail in that coffin that core strengthening is not the solution for persistent low back pain. And yet many physiotherapists are still, I've been a physio for almost 33 years and I've done my share of core strengthening, right? Probably 2 decades worth. And so it is kind of the default strategy and for low back pain and lumbopelvic pain, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it shouldn't be. And especially when we see the connection with overactivity and pelvic floor dysfunction, and then central sensitization with tenderness on palpation or overactivity. So it really takes us kind of out of the pelvis, out of the lumbar spine, and into the whole person and assessing what is going on with that person, really listening to their narrative. So I guess another strategy that I would like to see happen more consistently is to develop better motivational interviewing skills, where we really learn to listen to the patient's narrative and really, you know, once we've listened, help them, we co-create a new narrative with them, not just tell them what they've done wrong or what needs to change, but really kind of connecting with their story. And that takes a real skill set. I think that's true for pelvic health therapists and for orthopedic therapists. And I think for orthopedic or for pelvic health therapists, at least what I see in Canada, is get out of the pelvic floor, think about the lumbar spine, because there's also another series of studies that I haven't talked about. And again, they're just case series. There's 2 case series that have come out in the last 2 years where, and again, my confirmation bias, I'm a McKenzie credential therapist. So this is how I've always looked at patients. But it's nice to see these case series. But there's one by Dai Wu, who's actually an orthopedic surgeon from China, who then trained as a physiotherapist in Montreal. He published just a case series of 3 men who presented with lower urinary tract symptoms and treated them by treating their lumbar spine mechanically and got 59 to 75% resolution by just treating the lumbar spine mechanically, right? And then Christina Hughes, I'm sorry if I get her name wrong, from the West Coast in the U.S., who also is a board-certified pelvic health therapist and a McKenzie credential therapist, just published in 2019 a series of 8 case studies looking at 7 women and 1 man, again, presenting with lower urinary tract symptoms and treating them mechanically through treating the TL junction, which, of course, you know, we see a lot of referral through L1, L2 kind of into the pelvic area, and treating the lower sacral spine as well and resolving much of lower urinary tract symptoms, including incontinence, urgency, frequency, burning, pelvic pain. So I think as pelvic health therapists, we need to also see this connection and assess the whole person Right?
Yeah.
So those are probably, and then I think the third piece that I think these studies start to show us is that we need to start developing more skills and competency in our psychosocial screening and our identification of phenotypes of central sensitization. It was very interesting. I was at the European Society of Interstitial Cystitis meeting in Amsterdam. I just came from there. There were only two physios, well, I shouldn't say that, there were two physios from abroad that were at that meeting, myself and Julie Bond from the UK. And there was about probably eight physios from Holland and Belgium, because it was in Holland. And we had a physiotherapy workshop on Saturday for a couple of hours. And one of the physios, who's a prof in Belgium, presented on vaginismus and a very tissue-based approach to vaginismus. And so I said to her afterwards, we had a conversation around the role of central sensitization in vaginismus. And I said, you know, you must be at the same university as Joe Neisch, who's doing a lot of work. He's a physio doing a lot of work on central sensitization. I said, tell me how his work is influencing your practice at this point. And she said to me, well, vaginismus is just muscle spasm. It has nothing to do with the central nervous system.
Oh.
So that's the state that we're in internationally, right? I don't think that's uncommon. And what's happening in this patient population, particularly in interstitial cystitis, and you and I, before we got on air, were talking a little bit about the importance of hopefulness and recovery. But in this patient population in interstitial cystitis, for example, because they are it's a hallmark condition of central sensitization. It's highly correlated with central sensitization. If we take a tissue-based approach to IC and work on sort of trigger point release and fascial release that's painful, do you think we actually end up sensitizing them more or reducing their sensitization?
I would hypothesize more.
We're not
necessarily targeting the problem.
Right. But that's what's happening in the IC world is I'm quite involved in the patient advocacy group here in Canada, and the majority of IC patients will try physiotherapy for their trigger points, air quotes, and will only last two or three sessions, and they stop physiotherapy because it's too painful.
It's uncomfortable.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It causes too much pain for them, and they're already in so much pain. And so I guess what I really would like this research to start to direct people towards is developing and taking a broader whole person approach where the target becomes the central nervous system. And that's more than just adding meditation to your practice, right? So a lot of therapists will say, well, I treat biopsychosocially. I use meditation and yoga. Well, if meditation was the panacea for all things centrally sensitized, all we would do is teach everyone meditation and we would be okay. Right?
Right.
But if you don't measure the phenotypes of central sensitization, is this patient depressed? Are they anxious? Are they stressed? Are they catastrophizing or ruminating? Do they have sensory motor smudging? All of those have different evidence-based approaches. And so we first have to measure in order to treat the central nervous system.
And are those the phenotypes that you were talking about for central sensitization?
Yes. Yeah, the phenotypes that we as physiotherapists can interact with, right? So if they're severely depressed, we can look at the role of relaxation exercise like yoga. Yoga has good correlation with depression. Resistive exercise, the World Health Organization actually has said that people in depression who participate in regular resistive exercise training, that helps with depression. We also know that cardiovascular exercise helps with depression. So if someone's severely depressed and they aren't connected with a counselor, again, working in an interdisciplinary team is really important, but we have a role to play. It's a biopsychosocial perspective, right? And so again, we need to really understand what the literature says around depression and musculoskeletal pain. A strong correlation. Timothy Wideman did a study in 2012. He's a Canadian physiotherapist from Montreal as well, who showed that in orthopedic injuries, so all orthopedic injuries, the comorbidity of depression is 25 to 50% of people with MSK problems have comorbid depression.
Mm.
Right? And yet we don't assess depression. We don't use depression anxiety stress scales regularly. We don't assess catastrophization. We think of them as outcome measures, and I think of them as assessment tools that allow me mm-hmm. to identify the phenotypes of central sensitization that we can interact with as physiotherapists.
I think that's exactly how they should be utilized. And we give them, you know, thinking through kind of how we typically utilize them in general, to give them at the beginning, at the end, to see if there's been a change, but we're potentially missing an opportunity to actually intervene on something that
right.
we're finding.
Right, right. So we're using them as an outcome measure, right? I would
mm-hmm.
say, typically. And so think about when you assess a joint, right? You look at range of motion, you do your special tests. With central sensitization, if you use the CSI questionnaire, which has been validated to identify central sensitization, and they score greater than 40 on Part A, or they have any one of the conditions on Part B, then you can say with confidence to them that you have a sensitive nervous system. And you know what? Patients eat that up. They know they have
mm-hmm.
a sensitive nervous system. That doesn't offend them. That actually validates their pain experience.
Right.
And then you can start to say to them, so now on assessment, if you use the depression, anxiety, stress scale, if you use a positive effect, negative effect scale, looking at positive effect, if you use a fear avoidance scale like the TFK, if you use the sleep and pain, highly correlated, so you use the insomnia severity index. And Joe Neisch has written a beautiful article for physiotherapists in 2017 addressing how we as physiotherapists play a primary role in sleep re-education for pain, right?
Mm.
And so when we do those things really well and address them, and then, you know what, Alexandra, don't wait to discharge to redo them. In 6 weeks, redo them and see if your target is having an effect, just like you'd remeasure range of motion, just like you would retest special tests to see if your intervention is changing the tissues, right?
Absolutely.
Same thing with central sensitization.
This has given me a lot to think about.
Good.
Do you have an idea of what your next research article or next research project will be, kind of diving into this a little bit further?
Right. I would love to redo it on men, for sure.
Mm.
You have to understand at this point that I'm a clinician. I'm a clinician at
yeah.
heart. I'm an educator as well. I don't currently work with a funded lab, so funding is an issue. We do all of this research just because we believe it's important to do, and so there's no funding
mm-hmm.
currently. I do have somebody who's potentially interested in running an RCT, and I would love to run an RCT looking more specifically at treating low back pain from both a mechanical low back pain perspective. So again, probably taking out our high catastrophizers, maybe even taking out our CSI scores of greater than 40. So we can just start with not that more complex patient, but our more straightforward patient. And what I'd
right.
be interested in doing is doing an RCT looking at people with mechanical low back pain to see if and lower urinary tract symptoms, to see if actually treating the low back only versus treating the low back and pelvic floor actually produces different results, either in efficiency or overall effectiveness. So can you treat them faster and more effectively if you address lower urinary tract symptoms through the pelvic floor, or versus just treating them through the low back? So I would like to see that done, because I think that would be, again, really reinforcing for our orthopedic therapists that they can start screening and asking about lower urinary tract symptoms, identifying them and using a mechanical approach to address them, knowing when to then say, and now this needs to be referred to someone who does internal work.
Right. Kind of changing their mindset of how far they should go, but also may give them confidence that they can treat this patient population just with a potentially different twist, maybe not doing
right.
a lot of abdominal bracing or Mm-hmm. on the breast, as opposed to, you don't want to overactivate that pelvic floor further.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the low back pain guidelines that have produced in the last decade, right? So 2007, we've got DeLito's from 2012, we've got Coe's from 2010. So those are the more recent low back pain guidelines. Not one mentions pelvic floor dysfunction.
No.
Right?
No. So I think they talk about posture, but they don't talk about pelvic floor dysfunction.
Right. And what is the evidence behind posture and low back pain?
None, if I'm remembering that.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. There is no evidence. And yet here we do. We stand everyone up in front of us and we comment on their posture and we talk about posture. You know, posture has a role in acute mechanical pain for a short period of time. Like if flexion, you know, ticks off their low back pain, then keep them out of flexion for a week or two. But flexion isn't bad, right? So there's a role in certain conditions for a short period of time, but otherwise variability in posture is probably the more important message than ideal posture, right?
Right. The dynamic versus static and
You
know, prolonged positions, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no mention of pelvic floor or even any type of like organ, bowel, bladder. And if there is any mention, even in just our pure education, it's very inflammatory. It's scary, I think, to a lot of orthopedic therapists to get information about bladder symptoms. You know, we're going to send them all to the hospital with a pinched spinal cord because they're leaking. Which is something that I found kind of going from the orthopedic world into the public health world was a little confusing. And then going back and forth is kind of what people's thoughts are on what's an appropriate amount of leakage that's not an appropriate meaning, not life-threatening, versus...
Right. So Cauda Quina is actually very clear. Cauda Quina syndrome looks like this from an incontinence perspective. An acute onset of incontinence that they have a period, if you ask some good questions, they had a period where they couldn't void, usually about 8 or 9 hours, and then they started dripping. Right? Because it's actually a change to, like, it's an autonomic nervous system issue, and they are not getting appropriate sympathetic and parasympathetic control to control the internal sphincter. So that's what incontinence looks like in Cauda Quina. And bowel is fecal incontinence.
Right.
So it's this more acute, like, it has to fit the picture. So here's someone who developed acute onset of leg dominant pain with a period of time where they couldn't pee, and then they started to drip, 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 and they were not able to actually empty voluntarily. And they lost
very
bowel control of their bowels. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very different than your typical urinary incontinence patient. Absolutely.
Yeah. But if you don't know that, then you're going to send a lot of people to the hospital with the potential for Cauda Quina, right? And that's for me where my very strong training in mechanical diagnosis and therapy has really helped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to give you one other study if we have time. Audrey Long is a physiotherapist from Calgary. Lovely woman. And I actually helped on this study back in 2002. We were one of the test sites. And she was published in Spine. So first of all, how difficult is it to get published in Spine? And what she did was she actually had 350 some odd patients, 352, I think, if I remember right. Oh, I feel like I've lost you again. Are you there?
Nope, I'm here.
Okay, beautiful. All of a sudden it kind of cuts out a little bit. I'm thinking, oh, it might be dead again. Okay, so she had a large number of patients. And what they did was they assessed them mechanically to see if they had a directional preference, which is sort of the big piece of a mechanical diagnosis, right? Is there a way that they prefer to move that either worsens or improves their symptoms or centralizes or peripheralizes their symptoms? And so it was a randomized controlled trial. Once we established a directional preference, then there were three groups. They were either randomized to a treatment group in the direction of preference, or a treatment group in the opposite direction to which they demonstrated a preference, or a generic exercise group where they just did general range of motion and a bit of gentle, like, bridging and some strengthening exercises. And they followed them for 2 weeks. So in a 2 week period, so first of all, what's really interesting, this is acute and chronic low back pain patients. 74% of people with acute and chronic low back pain actually show a directional preference. And in 2 weeks, 74%. Now, there was a meta-analysis done in 2018 by Stephen May, and he showed about 66%. So even if we say two-thirds of everyone with chronic low back pain or acute low back pain has a mechanical directional preference, if you treat that directional preference, what she showed in that two-week RCT was that if they were treated in their directional preference, 94% of them resolved in 2 weeks. Wow. Medication, disability, pain, the whole nine yards. If they were treated in the opposite direction, only 26% improved, and generic exercise improved 40%.
Okay.
So there's a mechanical diagnosis and therapy is actually a very clear and concise and simple way of categorizing patients who have mechanical pain. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And if they have mechanical pain and you treat their directional preference, they should resolve in 2 weeks. And that's what I would find in my clinical practice. And then those who don't have a mechanical direction, they're centrally sensitized. That's sort of the difference, right? That last 25%, which kind of fits with that literature as well.
Right. And that's going to take something a little bit more, or a lot more.
Yeah, a lot more. But again, can respond really quickly if you identify the phenotypes of their central sensitization. Like I have women with bladder pain syndrome, you know, who will respond in 5 or 6 sessions to complete resolution when we identify the central drivers and deal with the central drivers, not with the pelvic floor tension. I monitor the pelvic floor tension. I interact with it a little bit. I'm still a hands-on therapist, but I don't ever talk to my patients about, you know, sort of skin rolling or connective tissue release or muscle release. If I'm going to interact with their muscles or tissues, it'll be in a non-threatening way that does not increase their pain. And I talk to them about having a conversation with their nervous system to teach them how to just let go of this area or, you know, sort of stop guarding this area. That's a discussion for another day. But I think when we have central sensitization, we have to be very careful to not use painful techniques because we will sensitize them more, and to not
and
use
think,
biomechanical. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add it, and just even you were saying you don't have the conversation with them about skin rolling or trigger points. So we're not even using painful language, kind of talking about kind of that, you know, it's a palpation, it's going to touch, it's going to hurt, and kind of getting away from that, I think, can be so helpful as well.
Absolutely. Our language is either nocebic or placebo, right? So it either becomes a nocebo or language actually harms them further, right? And I think that's why it's important for us to really discuss getting away from the use of trigger points as a diagnostic tool or language, because we set up this belief that there's a structural problem in the muscle, and that structural problem has to change before they can feel better, right? So that becomes a nocebo, really.
Right.
A negative expectation.
And the amount of people who come in, say, my trigger points are still there, and I use my wand, and you know, they just come back, and that's really, that's the problem. It's because they're not the problem.
Right.
Not the trigger point. It's not the help. Yeah.
Right. So I never use a wand.
Okay.
I just never use a wand because, again, the tissues are not generally, in central sensitization, the tissues are not my target. I'm observing the tissues. We're interacting with the tissues. We're noticing what's changing. We're having a conversation with the tissues. It's maybe how I talk about it. But I am not fixing trigger points. I'm not fixing tight fascia. I am not doing a lot of visceral mobilization where, again, I have to look at scar tissue. And if they're tight, we'll definitely interact with it. But it shouldn't be painful. It should just be tight, right?
Right. Absolutely. Pain is something else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have a few minutes left. My last question that I ask everyone for my interviews, and you've given me a huge bibliography of studies that I'm going to look into and start accumulating. I was wondering if you have any resources that you utilize for patients, your centralized patients or these people who are coming in the door and don't really know what you're going to be talking about. Do you have anything for them to kind of start the healing process or start the education?
Yeah. So it depends on their own level of understanding and you know, whether they like to read or how they like to learn. But usually I will start with some connecting to sort of pain education, right? Pain education is just a stepping stool to then treating the central nervous system. Because I think often what we do is we educate patients about pain and then we treat the tissues.
Right.
So I'm going to just say right up front here, I have co-authored a book about pelvic pain that's written at a very sort of basic level. Usually the average reader in the U.S. and Canada reads at about the grade 6 level. So Adrienne Lau's work is sort of targeted at that level. So with Adrienne Lau and Sandy Hilton, I co-authored a book, and so I need to disclose up front. If 10 of you buy that book, I probably can get a Starbucks coffee. So I do make a little bit of money on that, so I'm going to say that really clearly. But Why Pelvic Pain Hurts can be an easy intro into that information. Certainly, if they're more of an auditory learner, I would say tamethebeast.org, not .com, tamethebeast.org. Laura Mosley's new pain education video is a great place to start. Neil Pearson here in Canada has written a little higher level. So Adrienne Lau's work, again, is written at a more basic level. If you have someone who really wants to understand more detail, Understand Pain, Live Well Again is written by Neil Pearson. And he has a lot of great resources. He has a lot of yoga resources for people in pain that I really like as well. And so those are some places that I would start.
Those are fantastic. We're going to add those to the library.
Awesome.
All right. So that's all the time we have. I just want to thank you so much for coming on this show, Carolyn. This has been really lovely. Sorry about my little exit in the middle.
That's okay.
Technology is always an adventure.
Yep.
To our listeners, if you want more information or you'd like to give back to the pelvic pain community, please visit the International Pelvic Pain Society website at pelvicpain.org. I'd like to thank our sponsors who make the show possible, Beyond Basics Physical Therapy in New York City and the International Pelvic Pain Society. And thank you, listeners, for coming and listening to us. And stay tuned for more upcoming Pelvic Messenger blog talk radio shows. Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, listeners. And I hope everybody has a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Alexandra. Bye-bye.